Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the process for the Democratic presidential nomination begins in earnest this fall, a veteran progressive economist joins us and offers his view on a winning formula for a challenger to the president. And moreover, he believes the stakes at hand demand a progressive candidate. As he puts it, a return to normal is not enough. Normal set far too many Americans back over the past 50 years. His book is titled The Stakes. Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He's a former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe, and was also co-founder of the Economic Policy Institute. He's currently the Kirstein Chair and visiting professor in social planning and administration at Brandeis University. He's the author of numerous books, including the 2008 acclaimed book, Obama's Challenge. More recently, he's the author of Debtor's Prison, The Policies of Austerity Versus Possibility, and Can Democracy Serve Global Capitalism? His latest has just been published, The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. It's published by Norton. Robert Kuttner is my guest today. Robert Kuttner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You described your new book, The Stakes, as one part alarm and one part hope. But I have to ask you about the subtitle of the book, The Survival of American Democracy. That seems to play to the alarm suit. Do you really think that our democracy hinges on this next election?
I do. If you look at what President Trump has done with executive power in his first 2.5 years, and you look at all the opportunities there are that he has not yet succeeded in pursuing, that he could do in 4 more years, the risk is that we could become another of those countries that has the forms of democracy but not the substance, where the president doesn't respect the rule of law. The founders of the American Republic relied heavily on separation of powers to contain a runaway executive, but they did not reckon with the possibility of the executive branch, the judicial branch, and certainly during Trump's 2 years, the entire legislative branch all being in the same hands. And you look at all of the emergency legislation that was drafted by Congress for true emergencies that Trump has simply used to try to govern by decree, and his claim that he could pardon himself, and his claim that he doesn't need to comply with subpoenas. I mean, all of this has been reported up, down, and sideways. And then I look at, in one of my chapters, what he could do in a second term. I mean, he still has not succeeded in turning some of the police agencies into his own personal servants, like the CIA and the FBI and the IRS. He could do that in a second term. And he could really make much more of an effective war against the press in his second term, and I have a whole discussion of this. So, yeah, I do. I honestly think that 4 more years of Trump, we would be a democracy in name only.
You write about Robert Barr being appointed as Attorney General, and he's well known for his unitary executive views, and you have a discussion of that in the book. That idea that an attorney general will back that unitary executive idea, how frightening is that to you?
Well, it's very frightening. I mean, if you think about Jeff Sessions in the first couple of years, Sessions was very conservative. Some people felt he was a racist. But in terms of defending the semi-autonomy of the Justice Department to not just bend to the president's will, he was very much of a traditionalist. Barr's view is that the president can do whatever he wants to do, and to have the Attorney General of the United States certifying that and enabling Trump rather than resisting some of his more autocratic impulses, that's truly dangerous. And I think if you look back on the first 2 years, you know, there were a number of mainstream minders who kind of contained Trump's crazier impulses. You had more mainstream White House chief of staff. You had the generals who were at the National Security Council and at the Pentagon and at Homeland Security, who were more mainstream conservatives. Trump has succeeded in getting all of these guys out. And so now, you know, you have Mulvaney, who is more Trumpian than Trump, urging Trump to be even more of a caricature of himself. And so he's even more dangerous now than he was 2.5 years ago.
I want to get back to a statement you meant a moment ago, and you write about at some length in the book, the idea that we would have the form of a democracy, but not the substance. What would that look like in your view?
Well, you would still have a press. I think it would be more and more intimidated because Trump tried and would try again to go after the corporate ownership of the press. Trump would try to use libel laws. So the press, and also, by the way, in the prosecution of Julian Assange, which the Obama administration felt was not constitutional, Trump is relying on the 1917 Espionage Act, which is extremely broad. There's a precedent there where you could go after any reporter or any publisher or any publishing company that deliberately or inadvertently disclosed national security information. We don't have an Official Secrets Act in the United States, but by making selective prosecutions under the Espionage Act, you, in effect, could have an Official Secrets Act. So there are all these things that Trump could do. So you'd have a much weaker press. You'd have an opposition party that had no powers, and Trump and the Republicans have been very successful at really not letting the Democrats in Congress play any kind of role, and then that did change in 2018 when the Democrats took the House. And so to shift from the alarm to the hope, you know, there is enough of American democracy alive and well, as proven by the Democrats' success in the midterms, and for that matter, as proven the day before yesterday by the ruling of a three-judge court in North Carolina that the districts that had been created based on racial gerrymandering were unconstitutional, not according to the federal constitution, but according to the North Carolina constitution. So there is enough of American democracy alive and well that we are going to have a real election in 2020. I mean, I don't think, not one of these people who's so paranoid with that thinks that Trump is going to cancel the election or that if he loses, he's going to refuse to go. I don't think we're quite there yet. But I think if Trump wins the election, he will become more and more of a dictator.
You also offer a diagnosis of what you see as the damage done to democracy, and this is a bipartisan issue going back about 50 years or more, the rise of executive power, the growth of the imperial presidency, the close ties between business and government, and the cozy relationship between both. I was struck by one of those, is the growth of media and the shrinking of civic organizations and engagement. What effect has this had?
There is a famous study that was done by a sociologist named Theda Skocpol, and she went back and looked at civic engagement in American history, and she found that about 100 years ago, there were 53 separate organizations, each of which had at least 1 million dues-paying members. You had local groups that then elected representatives to state groups who elected representatives to national groups. What you have now is you have letterhead groups where you become a member by writing a check, but there's no democratic organization, small d, democratic, of the group. It's just typically a letterhead group with a professional staff in Washington. And so that's a weakening of the grassroots of democracy. You have fewer people with the time or the interest to turn out for humble things like zoning appeals and all of the things that make democracy function at the local level. You have more people watching television or participating in social media and thinking of that as a form of civic engagement. And so I think democracy has been weakened by all of that. And then, of course, when you had 9/11 and the fear of terrorism, you had a whole new increase in secret government, executive power. So all of this has just moved one way. And as I write, if Trump's election in 2016 had elements of an accident, it was an accident waiting to happen. And I think the other absolutely key point is how aggrieved ordinary working people are at how the economy has been taken away from them. And that's why I argue that a progressive Democrat needs to run on a kind of program of progressive populism to win back some of those people, to have the Democratic Party more like it was in the age of Roosevelt when, as you know better than I do, Oklahoma was a rather populist state.
Yes, it was populist, but it was populist conservative, always conservative, I really think, except for maybe a few years at the very beginning of our statehood, and that ended pretty quickly.
Well, Fred Harris was a progressive populist.
This is true.
It had elements of both.
Yeah.
It had elements of both in the sense that, I think I'm right, that the very first prepaid group health plan came out of Oklahoma. So there was a kind of agrarian radicalism that was a big tradition in Oklahoma that was pretty well extinguished by the 1980s. And I think ordinary people hunger for a government that is on their side economically. Now, there are conservative versions of that. There are more progressive versions of that. But ordinary people have taken the most incredible beating economically in the past several decades and have correctly perceived that both parties are cozier with Wall Street than they are concerned about the fortunes of regular people. I mean, Roosevelt, even though he was avant-garde on race, and Eleanor was even more avant-garde than he was, regular people who were not racial liberals voted for him because he was doing something for their pocketbooks.
My guest today is Robert Kuttner. He's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He also holds the Kirstein Chair of Visiting Professorship in Social Planning and Administration at Brandeis University, and the author of The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy, published by Norton. We'll talk about pocketbook populism, as you call it, in a moment, but I want to get first to as the Democratic race for the nomination for president really begins to heat up, among undecided Democratic voters, I think there's a lot of angst between supporting a centrist candidate that conventional political wisdom says has the best chance of unseating President Trump versus a more progressive candidate that, according to that same wisdom, could alienate swing voters and cost Democrats the election. You believe that's a false construct. Why?
I think the fact that so many people have fallen behind economically and that neither party has been serving their interests, that's the secret sauce for Democrats in 2020. And when Joe Biden calls for a return to normal, normal wasn't good enough. A lot of people were very unhappy with normal. That's why they voted for Trump. So I think if you look at the world of the swing voter, there are different kinds of swing voters. For me, the most important swing voters were the voters in the Midwest who used to be stalwarts of the Democratic Party who defected to Trump because they didn't see the Democratic Party doing anything for them. So that's one kind of swing voter. Then you have, suburban moderates. That's a different kind of swing voter. But I think a lot of suburban moderates are so disgusted with Trump that they're primed to vote for the Democrat. That's what happened in the 2018 midterm. The Democrats turned 43 Republican seats. A lot of the people who ran were progressive. Some of them were more moderate, but almost all of them ran on kitchen table economic issues: Social Security, Medicare, decent wages, affordable higher education. So you have a kind of more gentle version of pocketbook populism. You have a more strident version of pocketbook populism. But I think that's what people need. And, in Oklahoma, as you know, the Democrats picked up a seat that they hadn't held in four decades. They almost picked up another one. I think people are ready for a party that champions their economic interests.
Now, a lot of those suburban moderates you talk about, They're mainly turned off by the president's behavior. I mean, maybe some by their policies, but I think they're, at least in this part of the country, they tend to be more in line with the policies, but maybe turned off by the president himself and his behavior and the way he handled himself in the office.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, I think there's a latent anxiety about the fact that my child cannot afford to go to college, except by saddling herself or himself with a lifetime of debt. There's a latent anxiety about, I have health insurance now, but what if I have to change jobs? And even people who are moderate share those anxieties. There's anxiety about the fact that good payroll jobs are drying up, even though the economy on average is supposed to be good. So, yeah, there are some moderates, I agree, who might be turned off by an economic progressive candidate. But I think there are more swing voters who stand to be won over by such a candidate. And also, let's face it, Joe Biden, who is the standard bearer of this conventional wisdom about we need to elect a moderate, he's not a great candidate. And I think the fact that he is weakening over time is a reflection of his own shortcomings as a candidate. So I think if the centrists had a more compelling standard bearer, I think it would be a closer question, but I think they don't.
I want to ask you, you spend a little bit of time sort of rehashing the 1972 election when Richard Nixon ran for re-election. I want to ask you about maybe some parallels to McGovern in 72, the idea that he was, the Democrats nominated somebody who was just a little too progressive for the times, and you had a candidate that had no qualms about using dirty tricks and other methods in the election. Do you think there are any parallels
to having a progressive
candidate?
I think there's one enormous difference, and that is that the Democratic Party was split right down the middle over the Vietnam War. And, the trade unionists tended to be conservative on the Vietnam War. They tended to support the Vietnam War. A lot of young people were more critical of the war. And that split the Democratic Party like nothing had split the Democratic Party literally since the Civil War. And I think any Democrat in 1972, I covered that convention, would have had a really difficult time defeating Nixon, especially given what a master of dirty tricks Nixon was. But Nixon in 72, before he came apart with Watergate, was a very effective politician. So it's also interesting that you have to go back to 1972 to find a Democratic candidate who arguably was too left-wing for the electorate. In every election since then, the Democrats have nominated a relative political moderate. I mean, even Obama, he was a breakthrough candidate because he was African-American. But despite a lot of what Republicans said about him, his policies were not all that left-wing. In fact, his economic team, headed by Robert Rubin of Goldman Sachs and Citibank, was among one of the most pro-Wall Street Democratic presidencies we ever had. So it's interesting because even though the conventional wisdom is, well, you got to be careful that the Democrats, are going to appoint somebody too left-wing to get elected, not since McGovern has a leftist been nominated by the Democratic Party, and they've won some and they've lost some. But it's under Democratic centrist presidents, Carter, Clinton, and then Obama, that the good life has gotten away from American working families.
You offer and advocate that a successful Democratic candidate should advocate for pocketbook populism. What does pocketbook populism look like?
Well, I think in terms of the narrative is that the economy is being rigged by powerful interests on behalf of powerful interests, and you are not getting your fair share. And if government policies were different, you could be getting your fair share. This has nothing to do with technology. It has nothing to do with globalization. It has everything to do with policies that your government has chosen that tilt the economy in favor of Wall Street and away from you. So that's the message. And then, the concrete policies, I have a whole compendium of them.
You do.
I think we need a very substantial infrastructure program. I think we need a higher minimum wage. I think we need a kind of economic patriotism where we rebuild the country rather than thinking that our self-interest is to be globalizers. And you can argue about the specifics of universal health coverage, but I think we need true universal health coverage. We need affordable higher education. And I, you know, you can debate the details. We need to modernize infrastructure that hasn't been modernized since the New Deal. I think most Americans would be in favor of that. And I want to put in a kind word for pork barrel. Pork barrel is one of those words that gets turned into a, you know, a term of abuse. But if you think about it, the idea that public works spending should be spread around to the whole country, which is disparaged as pork barrel politics, that's actually what we should have.
Yeah. You know, the famous bridge to nowhere, if you'd actually built the bridge, it would be a bridge to somewhere.
That's a great line. Well, I mean, look at rural electrification.
Yes.
Look at land reclamation. I mean, one of the problems of the economy right now is that far too much of the economic growth has been concentrated in a handful of metro areas. And we need to spread the growth around. One of the great things the New Deal did, you know, through TVA, through rural electrification, through the great western dams and water systems. I mean, Roosevelt was a savvy politician, and he realized that a lot of the country was suffering. Some of the country was suffering much worse than other parts of the country. And the benefits of the New Deal needed to be spread around. Now, the people who kind of place all their money on high tech is good for a handful of metro areas, not good for the middle of the country. And that needs to be changed.
I want to talk a little bit about infrastructure since, you know, both parties give, and even the president gives, a lot of lip service to infrastructure and finding a deal on infrastructure. Yet nothing's been done over the last 3 years. And the last infrastructure bill that came through, which came in the wake of the financial crisis, was bitterly opposed by one party. I noticed they all signed,
right. They
all showed up when they cut the ribbon, but it was bitterly opposed at the time. And why can't we get infrastructure done if everybody says we need we do need to improve our infrastructure, everything from the electric grid to you know, you make an argument for high-speed trains going across the country, not just in the Northeast or on the West Coast. Why can't we get something done?
Well, Trump, as you say, talks a very good game on infrastructure, but his version of an infrastructure program is very little federal money and almost all private investment, privatization of roads and privatization of this and privatization of that. It's not clear that the private sector is going to put up that money unless the terms were so lucrative that you'd end up really soaking consumers. So public infrastructure needs to be public infrastructure, and that's an issue that divides the two parties. Democrats are for it. Republicans, for the most part, are against it. I mean, if you had taken some of the $2 trillion that Trump gave mostly corporations and very wealthy individual investors, if you'd taken some of that $2 trillion in Trump's tax cut, which ordinary people haven't seen very much of, and put it into infrastructure, you know, you could afford one heck of an infrastructure program.
Yeah. I want to ask about another item in your agenda, which is a Bill of Rights for America's Young.
Yes.
What would that look like? What would be a part of a Bill of Rights for America's Young?
Well, look at the world from the perspective of a 26-year-old who doesn't have wealthy parents. So if that 26-year-old wants to get a college education, you end up being saddled with debt. If you're trying to find an affordable home and want to start a family in an area with a decent school district, that's probably unaffordable. If you want to find a payroll job with decent fringe benefits, you're more likely to find a contingent, part-time, temporary, gig kind of job. And I think this generation of young people is getting more of a raw deal on the economy than any generation since the generation like my dad's generation that came of age in the Great Depression. So it's time to package all of those concerns and address the fact that this generation is really behind the eight ball economically, and there are things that the government could do. It can make a public higher education free the way it was for 100 years. I mean, between Lincoln and the land-grant colleges, which started in 1862, and the 1970s and 1980s, tuition and fees at a public university were a few bucks. And Elizabeth Warren tells the story of spending $50 a semester when she went to community college in Oklahoma. And so that's the way it should be. It's not exactly a radical idea. It was totally mainstream for more than a century. And you can have a program of debt relief so that young people realize that somebody in the government is paying attention to all the ways that they're getting the short end of the stick.
I want to ask about one thing that you mentioned just a moment, a program of economic patriotism. I think the president in his own way has been advocating for that, but I think you're talking about reducing businesses' sort of myopia on shareholder value to include community, their employees,
yes,
and other stakeholders in their commitment to American business. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean economic patriotism in two respects. I mean, first of all of the trade deals that presidents of both parties have negotiated have made it easier for companies to move operations offshore. And one of the benefits of a big infrastructure program is that you could insist that those companies do that work at home, and you could use it as a way of reclaiming technologies that we invented, like solar, that the Chinese have just made off with by subsidizing their companies so that they offer the cheapest product, even though it's not a real market price. It's a subsidized price. And I think the other face of it is, yes, America's corporations, if you look at the way they actually behave, a lot of them talk a good game when it comes to patriotism, but they're very quick to move operations offshore, even though they complain about China stealing their intellectual property and requiring them to take Chinese partners who are going to displace them over 10 or 20 years. A lot of them are taking the deal. I mean, China offers Intel or GE $1 billion to build a new factory, and you have cheap, docile, well-disciplined labor. So they go overseas, they take the deal, and China says, hey, you've got to take on a Chinese partner and share your technology and your trade secrets with them. And the corporate executives grouse about that, but they take the deal. So, you know, we need to redefine patriotism so that it includes not just flag waving and military parades, but so that it includes the behavior of corporations.
So getting back to this idea of pocketbook populism, do you think that is a winning formula for any candidate in 2020?
I do, and I'm not advocating any particular candidate as such. I mean, I've written a kind of playbook that's available for any candidate to use. I mean, obviously, if you look at the actual candidates, Elizabeth Warren's probably the closest to the strategy I'm advocating. But I think that's the most winning. It's not just the most winning strategy for a Democrat. It's what the country needs. And I think if it's articulated well, people will realize that such a candidate is acting and proposing strategies that serve regular people. And I think you could win a bigger mandate by pursuing that strategy and that narrative than by saying, I'm a centrist and let's have moderation and let's return to normal, because this is not a time for a return to normal. Normal was what left so many American working families behind, so many regions behind, and that's how Trump got elected in the first place.
Robert Kuttner, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and the author of The Stakes, 2020 and the Survival of American Democracy. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.